From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump meets with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping today at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. They're expected to discuss security and trade. Here was President Trump today on Fox News' Fox and Friends.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. Nobody really knows. We have not been treated fairly on trade for many, many years. No president's taken care of that the way they should have. And we have a big problem with North Korea. We're going to see what happens.
So the hope is to get them to bring leverage on the issue in North Korea.
Well, we're going to
But these are two strong-willed leaders. How much compromise can we expect? And speaking of which, there was none in the Senate today. The Democrats, as promised, filibustered the vote on Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. And the Republicans, as promised, pulled the nuclear option, changing the rules to send the nomination on to a full vote. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
So let's start with the meeting today. Chinese President Xi Jinping, known for having a very planned style, every event perfectly choreographed. Donald Trump, not so much. So how's that going to play out in this meeting?
Well, yeah, I guess that be ready, because President Trump is, as he said yesterday, he's a flexible guy. He can change and he can have a whim. Interestingly, though, today he has not yet tweeted. That might be a sign that he is, you know, heading into this meeting not wanting to mess anything up. And the reality is that there is no, according to White House officials, no set agenda for this. They didn't negotiate what they would talk about. And this is a meeting that is going to last less than 24 hours. This is the beginning of what is likely to be a 4 to 8 year conversation, depending on various elections.
Well, and it's being held at Mar-a-Lago, as we said. That's not new. Ronald Reagan hosted world leaders at his ranch. But what do you think Mar-a-Lago will do for this meeting that Washington doesn't?
Well, President Trump really wanted this meeting to be at Mar-a-Lago. They had to convince the Chinese delegation to do it there. And part of the reason is that the president simply feels more comfortable at Mar-a-Lago than he does at the White House. He is surrounded by people he knows. It is, you know, it is his home away from home. And so the idea is that they can have a more informal conversation. The other thing is that it doesn't have all of the pressure of a meeting in Washington at the White House, where if they didn't hold a press conference, that would be a really big story, because typically a foreign leader comes in, they do a press conference where each leader takes two questions. Well, in this case, they are not expected to have a press conference. They're not really expected to have any availabilities, just a few pool sprays where, photos can be taken of them sitting together or talking or walking.
Well, what about the language that preceded this? I mean, Donald Trump has called China's trade policy raping the U.S. How does he smooth that over? How does he make a change in what he sees as this huge imbalance?
Well, he has a lot of options. It's not clear that he plans to employ any of them in this meeting. Certainly, you can expect the president to talk about that trade imbalance. He probably won't use exactly those same words. There are lots of options that the president could use at some point, like tariffs or determining that China is a currency manipulator. But White House officials were sort of pushing back on the idea that any of that would really be pushed at this meeting.
Yeah. The president told the Financial Times it might be too early to talk about the huge tariff he wants to put on Chinese imports.
It's not a great way to, like, get to know you.
Right.
They're trying to build a relationship with this meeting.
Well, to the news in Washington today, just while we have you, Tam, as expected, Republicans in the Senate ended the Democratic filibuster of Neil Gorsuch's nomination by pulling that so-called nuclear option, because no one has ever wanted to pull it. It changes the rules, which means the next Supreme Court nominee in that debate, the minority party, whoever it is, also won't have a filibuster possibility, which is seen as kind of a veto. This can't help but drive a deeper divide in the Senate. Are you hearing any regrets?
Oh, there are lots of regrets. Everyone is saying that they regret having to do this, but they all felt that they had to do it. And if it didn't happen with this nomination, assuming that President Trump were to get another nomination, it would have happened with that one. Democrats were under a lot of pressure from their base to take a stand here. They feel like Merrick Garland, President Obama's choice, was really treated badly, and that he should be on the Supreme Court right now. And their base has not forgotten that, neither have those members. And Republicans feel like he should get a vote. He, you know, President Trump won. Elections have consequences. So this was a collision course that the Senate has been on, and now it happened.
The Democrats that we've spoken to have said they thought that that year-long delay on the Merrick Garland nomination was a filibuster. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, this week, President Trump said his administration is working on an infrastructure initiative which would allocate at least $1 trillion for a facelift of the country's roads and bridges, along with social infrastructure improvements to energy, water, and broadband projects. Seattle is in the middle of a huge infrastructure project right now. It's moving a 2-mile section of an elevated freeway on the waterfront underground. The project has just reached a milestone after nearly 4 years. The giant tunnel boring machine known as Bertha finally finished its dig underneath the city earlier this week. Kate Walters of Here Now contributor KUOW was there when Bertha finally broke through.
That is the sound of one of the biggest tunnel boring machines on Earth finally crossing the finish line. The huge round cut ahead looks like something out of a space movie as it grinds through the final barrier to daylight. After a nearly 2-mile long dig and more than 2 years of delays, Bertha is finally done. Washington Governor Jay Inslee says this is a momentous occasion and, despite some road bumps, he has no regrets.
When there were problems on this job, we were insistent that the contractor finish this job and fulfill its obligation to the people of the state of Washington. And today, when you see this tunnel boring, the only thing stronger I think I've seen is King Kong, and now we got ourselves a tunnel. So I'm glad we kept going.
The tunneling project has been a mammoth undertaking, and officials say its completion marks a key milestone in the effort to provide fast and reliable trips along State Route 99 for cars and freight. They say the route supports the movement of more than $30 billion in cargo each year. King County Executive Dow Constantine says the completion of Bertha's dig is a defining moment for the region, on par with the founding of the University of Washington and the building of the Space Needle.
Those were moments that helped define what this region is and what we will become. And just as we completed this remarkable work of engineering today, we are going to continue to build because entropy is not a friend.
Bertha's job may be done, but it wasn't all smooth sailing. The machine overheated in late 2013, causing massive delays. The $2 billion tunneling project could also come in as much as $149 million over budget. There's an ongoing court battle over who will pay for the cost overruns, but Seattle Mayor Ed Murray says it won't be the city.
We don't ask any city or county in this state to pay for a state project. If we begin asking one city to pay for it, all cities will pay for it. I don't think the legislature wants to go there.
Critics have also questioned the decision to sink millions into a new highway in an era where climate change is such a big issue. But to tunnel contractor Chris Dixon, this milestone is historic and has implications beyond Seattle. He says the fact that one of the biggest machines in the world could cut through tough soil conditions under a major city opens the door for other projects like this.
I think with what we've proven here, it's going to create opportunities going forward for other large diameter tunnel projects that were never attempted in the past until we attempted it on this project.
Seattle resident Wendell Wilson isn't thinking about more projects. He's surprised this one was finished at all.
No, I thought it was going to be at least another, one more breakdown in another year is what I was thinking.
Wilson drives State Route 99 every now and then, and he's glad Bertha's done and the new route is moving forward. Still, it'll be a while before Wilson or anyone else gets to drive through the new tunnel. Crews still have to complete the double-decker highway within and install electric, plumbing and safety systems. The old elevated road also has to be demolished, and a toll rate still needs to be set. That's right, there will be tolls. All in all, the state estimates the tunnel will open to traffic in 2019. As for Bertha, the machine will be disassembled over the next 4 to 5 months. Its job is finally done. For Here and Now, I'm Kate Walters in Seattle.
Well, earlier today, family and friends of astronaut John Glenn gathered at Arlington National Cemetery, where the sound of a military salute was dampened by the pouring rain. Mm-hmm. Glenn died on December 8th at the age of 95, but the final funeral rites and burial were held this morning. In 1962, John Glenn was the first American to orbit Earth, and upon his return, he was an instant American hero. After his career at NASA, he served 24 years representing his home state of Ohio in the U.S. Senate. And then, in October 1998, John Glenn slipped from Earth's gravity once again.
We have a go for engine start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and liftoff of Discovery with a crew of 6 astronaut heroes and 1 American legend.
He was 77, the oldest man to fly in space when he joined the crew of the space shuttle Discovery. After his death in December, Glenn's body lay in repose under the rotunda at the Ohio State House, and thousands of people attended the memorial services in Columbus. But his family said today's final ceremony at Arlington was reserved as a private opportunity to mourn. 100 years ago this week, the U.S. entered World War I. America had been neutral since the war started in 1914, but early in 1917, Germany increased the pressure on President Woodrow Wilson with its attacks on U.S. merchant ships. On April 2, 1917, President Wilson told a joint session of Congress it was time to enter the fight. Civilization, he said, was hanging in the balance. The Senate approved his war resolution on April 4th, and the House followed suit a century ago today. Joining us now is Michael Nyberg, chair of war studies at the Army War College. His most recent book is Path to War: How the First World War Created Modern America. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And tell us more about what was happening at this time in 1917 that pushed President Wilson to ask for that war declaration.
There had been a little lull at the end of 1916 where Americans were focused on other matters, domestic matters. But in early 1917, 3 things happened. One was that Germany announced it would resume unrestricted submarine warfare, which meant that American trade was likely to be damaged, Americans were likely to be killed. It also meant that the diplomacy that President Wilson had used in 1916 and 1915 had failed. The second event is the Russian Revolution, which took out the Tsar and, at least for a time, looked like it might bring a democratic government to Russia. That's what let Wilson use words like war to make the world safer democracy, because it looked like that might actually happen. And the third and probably most important was the Zimmerman telegram, which is released to the American people in late February of 1917, which revealed a German plot to sort of get Mexico and Japan in an anti-U.S. alliance. And in exchange for that, they would get Mexico back the entire American Southwest.
So the U.S. felt threatened.
Absolutely. And that threat had been there through 1915 and 1916. It had ebbed and flowed. By early 1917, that threat looks as real and as ever-present as it had been.
Was there a faction in the U.S. that was saying, no, no, let's still stay out of this war?
I think there was, but I think that faction was incredibly small by the start of 1917. There were folks who were arguing, as happened, that the United States should get in the war not to help Britain and France, but only to secure American interests. That voice is pretty loud in early 1917. But the number of real hardcore pacifists by early 1917 had dwindled to a really small number.
Now, the first U.S. troops didn't land in Europe until June of 1917. They fought for a little more than a year before the war ended in November 1918. But more than 100,000 American troops died. How much difference did the American participation in the war make?
I think it made a tremendous difference for a couple of reasons. One is that because Russia had gotten out of the war, it meant that Germany could take troops from the Eastern Front and shift them to the West. The arrival of American troops meant that that shift by the Germans couldn't have as much of a strategic impact as the Germans wanted it to. Second, there was a huge morale boost to the Allies, knowing that with 20,000 or so Americans arriving every day, it would be very difficult to lose this war. And third, it meant that French troops that had been serving in quiet sectors could be replaced by Americans in those sectors, and they could go to more active fronts. So I don't know that you can say that the Americans guaranteed Allied victory, but I think it's a safe thing to say that it guaranteed the Allies wouldn't lose.
And what kind of fighting were they doing in Europe?
They were involved in some of the worst sectors on the Western Front. The Meuse-Argonne sector, which is the largest battle the United States fought in the First World War, is fought between a forest and a river in a very narrow area that the Germans had defended. They had really had 3 years to set their defenses in, and they fought in some terrible, terrible terrain there, as well as a battlefield just before that called Saint-Michel, which is equally difficult terrain.
Hmm. So as we look back now, 100 years later, I have to say, you know, you hear a lot more about World War II than you do about World War I. You hear probably more these days about the Vietnam War and the Iraq War than you do about World War I. How did that war change America?
Well, I could talk about this for hours, but I think I would focus on the international relations aspect of it. This is the first time the United States had ever sent an armed force over to Europe. It's the first time the United States had decided to play this bloody European game. And I think it really set debates that we're still hearing today, whether America's role in the world ought to be independent, ought to be separate from alliances, or whether the United States ought to act within international institutions, some of which, of course, are created in the wake of the First World War. So that debate, which we're still having today, is, of course, a First World War debate. It's also the moment, I think, when the United States begins to have this question, this debate inside itself, of what American power really ought to be used for. Wilson believed it should be used for higher moral purposes. Some of his critics, Henry Cabot Lodge in the Senate and Theodore Roosevelt, the former president, argued that it ought to be used to pursue U.S. interests. And that debate is as intense today as it was 100 years ago.
Why wasn't World War I able to live up to its billing as the war to end all wars?
I don't think there's any way that you could have ended the First World War and made every group that had suffered understand their suffering. So that by the end of the war, what I think you're really trying to do, what the task for politicians is to explain to the people of Europe and the United States and all over the world, all through the empires, what that sacrifice had been for. And because that sacrifice meant different things to different people, I just don't see any way that a peace treaty or an armistice or any kind of agreement could have filled that empty emotional space. What the First World War did is take a world that was globalized, that was more or less stable, and it really broke it. And I think in some parts of the world, including the Middle East, we're still trying to find ways to put that world back together.
Michael Nyberg, you've written that as a country, there's sort of an amnesia about the First World War in the United States. Why would you say is it important that we remember this war?
I think it's important to remember this war in the terms of the people who lived through it, by which I mean it's easy to look back 100 years later and see the way that the world developed and see what happened to understand the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Holocaust, the Cold War, now ISIS. All of these things are products of the First World War. And look back on it and say this was a great mistake. And maybe that's a defensible argument. But I think we need to understand the world that these people were living in. It doesn't exactly resemble ours, but in many ways it does. A world of globalized trade, a world of interconnections, a world where people believe that a large state-on-state war is less and less likely. All of these things are still around. Global terrorism, all of these things that we're dealing with today are part of that world as well.
That's Michael Nyberg, who's chair of war studies at the Army War College. His most recent book is Path to War, How the First World War Created Modern America. And it was 100 years ago today that the House of Representatives approved a war resolution. The Senate had already approved it, and the U.S. entered World War I. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
And my pleasure. Thank you.
Along Florida's coasts are miles and miles of seawalls built to prevent the shoreline from eroding. But building that defense often means removing natural habitats like the forests of saltwater-loving shrubs called mangroves. Now, a couple of researchers have created fake mangroves in hopes of turning these solid barriers into thriving ecosystems for tiny sea creatures and bringing back some of the marine life that's been lost to development. Jessica Mazaros from WGCU in Fort Myers reports.
On Florida's Gulf Coast, the blue-green waters of Lemon Bay lightly lap against a cement wall that shields the buildings and people of Englewood from potential floods. What used to be here? Red mangroves, a labyrinth of small trees that provide habitat for fish, crabs, and oysters.
They're so attractive as an architectural kind of exhibit, the tree itself, the way it branches, the way the roots and branches overlap, and you get kind of a continuous structural network.
Keith Vanderreet is an architect. He partnered with biologist Jacine Aquino-Thomas to craft artificial mangrove panels that can be tacked right onto seawalls. They look like real mangrove roots, but they're white, made of concrete and ground-up oyster shells.
And the reason for this is that oysters, dead or alive oysters, send out a signal that tell other oysters, hey, this is a great place, come and colonize this area.
Aquino-Thomas says the artificial mangrove panels are designed with little nooks and crannies for small sea creatures to hide from predators. She comes back every 2 months to check the growth of marine life on the fake roots. And nearly half a year after they were installed, she's observing small fish, crabs, and some oyster larvae moving in.
You just start to get a lot of those soft-bodied animals in there, and I think they kind of look like cotton candy.
Green cotton candy.
That's great because it provides a different type of structure and different animals can live in there. And a lot of things that we might not notice are living in there, and they're all important for our ecosystems.
Aquino Thomas says this concrete and shell model will not produce the same nutrients as real mangrove trees. But she says just bringing back this structure increases biodiversity and will help clean the water. And the water in this particular area needs cleaning. That's what Teresa Carrither says. She's the manager for Westin's Wannabe Inn. The resort matched a grant of about $15,000 from the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation to help pay for the construction of these artificial mangroves. The resort is also hosting the project on its property.
I have noticed, you know, the decrease in some of the mangrove areas, but also an increase in red tide occurrences. So hopefully this will have some tie-in in facilitating to help with that.
All along Sarasota County's coast, Florida wildlife officials say they're recording a toxic red tide algae bloom persisting for months, causing respiratory issues for people and also fish kills. One frequent guest at the resort has noticed. Kelvin Haynes from Ohio has been vacationing here the last 5 years.
The fishing's not as good right now because of the red tide.
Haynes says these engineered mangroves are a good idea, and he'd like to see more of them. Architect Keith Van Der Riet says that's the goal. The imitation mangroves only cover about 20 feet along one seawall right now.
The next steps are integrating it to a seawall panel so that a full-scale seawall panel would be just dropped in. We wouldn't have to affix these things to the face of it.
The architect and the biologist say they'll be watching how marine animals and plants react to these artificial mangroves to continue improving their model. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Mazaros.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
And President Trump's pick to lead the Food and Drug Administration told a Senate committee yesterday that he'd speed up the approval process for new drugs. Dr. Scott Gottlieb served in the FDA under George W. Bush and has worked with firms that invest in biomedical companies. He told senators his industry ties would not interfere with his objectivity.
I'm going to work hard to make sure I preserve my integrity in this role and the integrity of FDA. I get it. I understand how important the impartiality of this agency is so that people can continue to have trust in the decisions that FDA makes.
But if Gottlieb is confirmed, he may have to go head-to-head with the industry to tackle rising drug prices. An article in the Harvard Business Review today describes the tactics that pharmaceutical companies use to keep drugs expensive. Kurt Nickisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, visits us regularly. He's here in the studio. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Robin.
So pharmaceutical companies have patent protection through the 1984 Act that rewards them for their investments. It protects them against competition. But then the patents run out, and that's supposed to help the consumer with lower price generics. But the review tells us that drug makers are still, you know, they have ways to control price. What are they doing?
Yeah, so that is the deal that they're basically trying to extend. They're trying to keep that practical monopoly going. And so they do things like pay for delay. They will actually pay generic drug companies not to make generic versions of the drug, just give them a cash payment so that they practically get to keep selling their brand name drug.
There's also something called a citizens petition that asks the FDA to delay a generic drug application, but...
Yeah, so that's actually by law supposed to be prioritized for citizens. The FDA slows down the process when those things are filed, but the FDA says that 92% of those citizens petitions are filed by drug companies.
They're corporations filing them, not citizens. Look, it also sounds like a part of the problem is with the companies manufacturing the generics. As you write in the review, they don't help their own cases. In 2015, there were 267 recalls of generic products. So what are the generic companies doing wrong?
You know, a lot of this is manufacturing hassles like contamination or a drug not absorbing properly. And so generic drug companies have had problems, and that has meant that the FDA regulates them more and pays closer attention to them. And so all of those hassles there in getting good quality generic drugs out, you know, onto the market basically does the same thing, which is slow down the process of generics and lower cost drugs coming to market.
Right. Look, the review writes about a heart medication made by the drug company Valiant. When it was no longer protected by a patent, in theory, the cost should have gone down. Instead, it went from $440 a dose to about $2,700 a dose. Now, it could have been any of those things we talked about, but the generic equivalent was discouraged in some way. There was no generic, so the company could just raise it.
Yeah.
Has President Trump's picked ahead the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, said anything about how he'll tackle this?
Yeah, in his confirmation hearing this week, he did say that this is something he's going to work on. He is definitely more of the type of guy to say, look, generics are being regulated too much. It costs them too much to file an application to start making a drug. He wants to bring those costs down so that they can start bringing these cheaper drugs to market sooner.
Okay, we'll see how that plays out. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you got it.
Protesters are taking to the streets across Caracas today, nearly a week after a controversial decision by Venezuela's Supreme Court that seized power from the country's legislature. The court has since suppressed parts of that ruling, but political unrest continues. The Supreme Court is loyal to the leftist president, Nicolas Maduro, while the National Assembly is controlled by opposition parties. One of those opposition parties is Voluntad Popular, or Popular Will, whose co-founder joins me now from Miami. Carlos Vecchio, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And do you think that the Venezuelan Supreme Court's move to suppress parts of its ruling from last week offer any hope that there's an end in sight to the political turmoil in Venezuela?
No, I don't think so. Actually, the dictatorship remains in Venezuela. The problem is not two sentences that they just changed. The problem is that there is more than 54 decisions from the Supreme Court, which take out powers from the National Assembly. So the dictatorship is still in place in Venezuela, and this is bringing also economic and social crisis for all Venezuelans. So in my view, is the other way around. I mean, is increasing the problem right now in Venezuela due to these decisions that the Supreme Court took recently.
And do you have any options as a member of an opposition party in Venezuela, even though you're living in the United States? Is there anything that you can do to try to push back against what's happening?
Well, actually, I've been denouncing internationally what is happening in Venezuela right now. And last week and this week, I went to the OAS, the Organization of American States, in order to discuss the Venezuelan crisis. And actually, 2 days ago, the OAS approved a decision saying that in Venezuela, there is an alteration of the constitutional order. I've been pushing this in the international arena in order to get the support of the entire community, the international community, in order to support the fight that we are doing in Venezuela.
But is it possible for the international community to put the pressure on that will turn the tide in Venezuela, or is it going to have to come from within?
Absolutely. I think both. I mean, we need to resolve this within or among Venezuelans, but at the same time, we need the support of the international community. Because when you are talking about democracy, the respect of human rights, those elements don't have a nationality or, you know, borders. So you need the support of all Democrats people around the world. So it's a very important the engagement of the international community in order to restore democracy in Venezuela. Okay, we need both in our view.
We spoke with a reporter in Caracas last week after the first Supreme Court ruling came out that people said was pushing Venezuela toward dictatorship. And one of the things that he said was that there weren't huge protests like there have been in Venezuela before. Why do you think that is? Are the opposition parties, are the people who are opposed to Maduro backing down?
Yesterday, actually, we had a huge demonstrations in Venezuela. We had also a brutal repression against the people who are demonstrating on the street in a peaceful manner. We are facing not only a dictatorship, but at the same time, we are facing the worst economic and social crisis of our recent history. So people will remain on the streets because they are claiming for a better future that they don't have right now.
Now, you're one of a growing number of Venezuelans living in the United States. You've been here for almost 3 years. Why did you make the decision to leave Venezuela and come to Florida?
You know that I'm facing an order of arrest in Venezuela. They tried to capture me three years ago. I spent 108 days in hiding in Venezuela. And after that, we decided that I needed to play an international role, that I was more useful outside of Venezuela instead of being a jail in Venezuela. So 3 years ago, I decided to leave Venezuela and to play these international roles. And since then, I've been, you know, denouncing internationally what is happening in Venezuela and also what we represent for the future of Venezuela. So it's like this is like a soccer team. You know, I have to play a role, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Do you expect to go back to Venezuela at some point?
Absolutely, absolutely. What I'm doing right now outside of Venezuela is just pushing to help the fight that we are doing underground in Venezuela, but also at the same time, I'm trying to prepare everything to return to our country.
But there are a lot of people like you who aren't under threat of arrest in Venezuela who have left Venezuela and come to the United States.
Yes, because they are looking for a future that they don't have right now in Venezuela. As I said to you, we are facing the worst economic crisis of our entire history, so they don't have future right now. And those are consequences of the political situation. And that's why they are just leaving Venezuela. In my case, I did it because of this political persecution, but some of them, they did it because they are looking for something better.
And I assume that many of them have been also pulling their money out of Venezuela.
Actually, they are just leaving everything behind. And they get here without just nothing, or some of them, for example, they have a professional career in Venezuela, and now here they have to do something different, not related to their careers.
Do you feel that President Maduro is more of a dictator than President Chavez?
Yes. In my view, both were dictators. Or Chavez was a dictator, but this Maduro has been even worse than Chavez, because Chavez, at least, he had money and he tried to handle the situation in a soft manner. But he was a dictator. I mean, he put this system in place. When he took power back in 1999, he started changing the constitution in order to control all the public branches in Venezuela. So he knew what he was doing. So he was a clear dictator, a new form of dictatorship. That's the way they put it right now. And Maduro, for me, I don't have any doubt, he's a clear dictator. And after this decision, as I said to you, from the OAS, which is saying that there is an alteration of the constitutional orders in Venezuela, now for the international community, now Maduro is considered a dictator.
But you've also got countries that are standing with Maduro.
Well, yes, probably yes. But when you look at those countries, you need to ask why they are doing that. Because they are getting money from Venezuela, at least in the case of Russia, and they are lending money to Venezuela. And as you know, it's quite difficult to call Russia as a democratic country. I don't see it that way. So they are very close. And also, Maduro is very close to Cuba, to Castro. So you can see that they are just, you know, in the same club.
Hmm. You know, there are all the political forces at play here, but there's also a major economic force, and that is the falling price of oil, and oil so important to the Venezuelan economy. Do you think that what just happened last week with the Supreme Court in Venezuela would have happened if oil prices were up at $100 a barrel?
I think $100 is not enough, because it's not a problem of the oil price. Is also because of our production is declining. We are producing less than 1 million barrels per day now. And also, the problem is the system. They have destroyed our economic capacity. Last year, we had the highest inflation in the world. We had the biggest economic contraction in our country, and we are facing right now one of the most difficult situation of shortage of basic goods and medicines. So it's not a problem of the oil price only. Hmm. It's a problem of the system. They don't believe in the private investment. They don't believe in the people. They don't believe in property rights. So they don't believe in democracy. So the problem is the entire system in which the oil price is part of it.
Carlos Vecchio, do you think that your political activity here puts at risk your friends and family who are still in Venezuela?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. I'm here with my wife and my son, but the rest of my family is in Venezuela. Of course, we have afraid about that. We have received a lot of threats, but we need to continue with our fight. We need to restore democracy in Venezuela, and that's what we believe, and that's what we want to do. And you know, these are the risks that you assume when you are taking this type of position.
That's Carlos Vecchio, who is national political coordinator for the Venezuelan opposition party Voluntad Popular, or Popular Will. Carlos, thank you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Not one, but two companies have had to pull ads and acknowledge the messages contained, even though inadvertent, were racist. Let's start with Pepsi. The ad shows actress Kendall Jenner as a blonde model at a photo shoot. Cameras are clicking. Behind her is a protest. She gradually notices the commotion, and soon she pulls off her blonde wig, hands it to a black woman standing beside her, whose job is apparently wig-holding, and strides through the protesters. They high-five her, smiling. As she picks up a canned Pepsi from a cold drink stand, she continues through the protest to a line of police officers, hands them the Pepsi. The crowd cheers. World peace breaks out. Well, Pepsi has apologized and pulled the ad after black and whites on social media howled that it diminished the efforts of real protesters everywhere and also those protesting police brutality. Then Nivea also had to pull a campaign, which started in the Middle East. Now, the goal there was to show that a deodorant they made wouldn't be visible on white or black skin, but the ad slogan was, "White is purity." Oy. Nivea's newest fans are white supremacists. Danielle Belton is managing editor of The Root in New York. Danielle, start with the Pepsi ad, just, you know, handing a can of Pepsi to an officer at a protest.
Pepsi had the response has been overwhelmingly negative. I mean, people have just really been up in arms about it. Someone tweeted that basically, you know, Kendall Jenner hands a cop a Pepsi and the cop goes, "I'm not racist anymore." You know, basically saying it's trivializing racism. This new Pepsi ad is invoking imagery of Aisha Evans as the protester in Baton Rouge. It's total exploitative brand activism BS. And my favorite response was from Bernice King, the daughter of slain civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. "If only daddy would have known about the power of Pepsi."
Dear. You know, because the ad does imply that if you just give someone a Pepsi, everything's fine. Of course, you know, there were ads in the past, Coca-Cola, you know, showing people handing Coca-Colas out and the world was a better place. But you mentioned Aisha Evans in Baton Rouge. This is the African-American woman who stood in front of charging riot police. DeRay McKesson, who's a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement, also tweeted out, "If I had carried Pepsi, I guess I never would have gotten arrested. Who knew?" So kind of tone deaf on Pepsi's part there.
Yeah, it's really absurd. It's amazing that something like that, you know, went through so many hands of approval and still got made, where no one thought that this is really tone deaf to have the face of a protest movement be Kendall Jenner, a tall white woman, you know, taking off a blonde wig and handing it to some black lady before charging out into the streets to lead a protest with Pepsi. It's patently absurd.
Well, and by the way, people protesting civil rights issues have spoken out against it, but so have just protesters in general, because the protesters depicted in the ads are holding signs that say things like, "Let's have a conversation," or, you know, really kind of banal. But then there's Nivea. Now, Nivea is trying to explain that this campaign started in the Middle East, that it was about showing how their underarm deodorant isn't visible on the skin, whether the skin's black or white. But what ends up in the ad is this "white is purity" slogan. What happened there?
Basically, again, people just flipped out. You know, like one person tweeted in Nivea USA, "Didn't think this through, did you?" you know, people are asking, what on earth is white purity? Shame, shame, shame on you. Fire your marketing manager and anyone who approved this ad. You know, wow, Nivea USA, this is horrendous. Your comments are full of society's refuse. This cleared your marketing department PR nightmare.
We'll tell more about what that person meant, because white supremacists are seizing on this.
Yes, you basically have white supremacists across the country, you know, in various countries, basically seizing onto this ad. It's like, see, look, this is, you know, this is endorsing our message and our views. This is something we should be proud of. And that makes it even all the more disturbing that it managed to get through marketing, considering the fact that it's become like this symbol for white supremacists.
Well, Nivea's deleted the post, although, you know, it's like anything else that we talk about in social media. Once it's out, it's out. And the parent company, which is Beiersdorf Global AG, apologized for the post, saying diversity is part of our company. But it's so surprising they did this, because they have a past with making a mistake like this. In 2011, the ad for Nivea for Men, what was that?
Basically, it was an ad saying to re-civilize yourself that featured an African-American man who was clean-shaven, holding a disembodied head that had, like, longer curly hair and a beard, and he's, like, tossing the disembodied head away.
Oh, boy. Presumably his former self. You know, the idea of Nivea was, like,
yes,
clean yourself up, but yeesh.
It was really tone-deaf. Again, I don't know how these things made it out of marketing. I mean, this makes the case for why companies need more diversity, because, I mean, this just doesn't even make sense.
Oh, by the way, we should add that on that 2011 Nivea for Men advertising line, the Re-Civilize Yourself slogan was under the black man's image, under the white man's image that they also had. Again, a white man holding his own disembodied head with a more clean-up self. There was no Re-Civilize Yourself. So hard lessons learned, once again, by advertising companies. And, you know, the people who help them learn the lessons are on social media. Daniel Belton, managing editor of The Root, helping us take a look at social media this week. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think the headline of this segment is, what were they thinking? Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.